You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
There's a businessman who sells mattresses. He has a room full of mattresses, and one of them is priced considerably lower than the others. Now, the salesman knows that this low-priced mattress will sell and the others won't, but this does not concern him. The other mattresses function as decoys. Their purpose is not to be sold, but to impress the buyer with how much cheaper the low-priced mattress is. The next month, the salesman selects another mattress to be sold at a bargain price. It sells just as well. In this manner, he is able to go through his entire inventory. The salesman knows that for most buyers, the chief consideration when shopping is not quality or brand name or even necessity, but rather price. Cheap goods sell. They sell in spite of the immense social, cultural, and environmental costs that sometimes come with them. Ellen Ruppel Schell related this anecdote to me when I spoke with her earlier this week. She's a professor of journalism and also the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. I began my conversation with her by asking, why are we so obsessed with bargain goods?
Well, you know, it's really tough, and I count myself as probably a really prime example of someone who was seduced by price. I am what psychologists call deal prone. I'm very attracted by deals, and that is meant and is done quite purposefully by marketers and psychologists and people who are specialists in pricing. And doing this book was very interesting because I met a whole community of people who specialized in pricing. And then there's a subgroup of people who specialize in markdown, if you can believe it. I mean, there's actually large software packages worth millions of dollars that are dedicated to just determining when things should be marked down. So this is very, very sophisticated science, something that used to be an art. You know, a small merchant would decide, oh, you know, I have too many too much of one thing. I'm gonna cut the price for a week. That isn't the way it necessarily works, and it's certainly not the way it works at major discounters. This is the science. So they know what they're doing, and they know how to catch your eye and distract you. And it's well known that low price, especially extremely low price, a deep discount, causes you to act impulsively. It kind of disconnects the more rational side of your thought processes and engages the more impulsive, what Freud called the primary process in the brain. And it's like a bauble, you know, the bauble that you want to grab, or, you know, it's something you want to get. And it engages you in a kind of game-playing behavior that you think if you don't participate in this game, you're going to lose. You're going to be a sucker. You've got to grab that deal while you can. And in the book, I talk about all the different things that marketers do to get that reaction out of us, and it's extremely sophisticated. And it was really interesting for me to learn that because, as I said, I was a sucker for a deal. I mean, and I never really understood why, because I'm a rational person. I'm actually scientifically trained. I think of myself as very, very rational. And this emotional response, and it is a completely emotional response, really surprised me. And now I understand why.
Can you give us an example of one of the techniques that they use to attract us?
Oh, sure. For example, something called reference pricing. And I think we're all aware of this, but we're not. We don't realize how effective it is. So then, as you set a very, very high reference price on something, you say the manufacturer's suggested price or the full price is, say, $100, and you're selling it for $25. It's be deeply, deeply discounted. And that reference price is so seductive, you really feel like you've won the jackpot, because now you're getting something that's worth, quote-unquote, $100, and it's only 25% of the cost. Boy, what a great deal. Very, very difficult for people to pass that up. And in fact, research shows that whereas a sweater that was selling for $25 and, you know, as a full price might sit in the store for weeks, a sweater that's marked at 100 and selling for on sale for 25 will fly out of the store. And I talked to psychologists, business psychologists, who are actually experts in this stuff, and even they said reference pricing, just it's very, very difficult for them to ignore it. It is so seductive that they get pulled in. And I think we all do. So that's a very, very powerful technique that marketers use.
One store offering goods at cheap prices is IKEA. Unlike, say, Walmart, IKEA combines low prices with a good image or a socially acceptable image. How have they been able to do that?
Well, IKEA is a very, very interesting company, and that's why I actually traveled to Sweden to spend some time there, because I originally went to IKEA to take a look at what I thought would be sustainable design. However, when I got there, I learned that it was, in fact, not all that different in some ways than other discounters. And in fact, it was unique in some ways that make it even maybe a little more scary than other discounters. IKEA is a company that designs to price. It sets a price for objects, say 50 cents for a coffee cup or $100 for a table and two chairs. And then it charges its designers to create designs that can be built to that price. The designers are great. They're very clever and talented. But they're not the ones that actually build these things. So these objects are very well designed, highly designed, but they're not crafted by craftsmen. They're built in one of the, I think it's 52 countries, is that right? I'm not sure, that have suppliers, IKEA suppliers. Their largest supplier, of course, is China. And so IKEA commits really most of the sins that are committed by most discounters. They force down prices by putting a lot of pressures on their suppliers to keep prices very, very low, which forces their suppliers, particularly those in the developing world, to restrict working conditions and benefits for their workers, and also results in, I found, questionable environmental practices. And all the things we associate with the big box discounters are also true for IKEA. But IKEA has avoided, to some degree, the stigma of the big box discounters with very, very good public relations and a wonderful story that's built around one man, the original founder of IKEA, who is, by the way, one of the richest men in the world, who started off as a kind of a small town guy in Sweden and created this empire for himself. But, you know, poses as someone who is quite thrifty. In fact, he is notoriously stingy. He flies economy class on low-cost airlines and bargains with farmers for day-old vegetables. I mean, this is the image that he gives. And his message is that he wants to provide furniture for all, furniture for the masses at a good price. And it's sort of almost a socialist kind of idea. However, of course, the people who are making that furniture are not considered in this equation. And also what is not considered is the idea that furniture made in the Swedish tradition of particle board and manufactured in low-wage factories in the developing world is really part of the socialist ideal. Okay, so it's quite an incredible company. I think almost unique in the way it's combined the low price with the high status and an image of quality and environmental concern when in fact that is not the case.
Now, IKEA, I understand, is the third largest consumer of wood in the world. Where is that wood coming from?
Well, in my research, I found that most of the wood comes from the Far East of Russia. And this is a forest region that is very, very hard to police. It's very difficult to know how the wood is being harvested and whether or not it's being harvested legally. Now, to be fair, IKEA does have a team of forestry monitors who try to get a handle on this. But the director of their forestry unit told me that it's impossible to patrol such a large region of the world. And in fact, they cannot guarantee that the wood is harvested legally. Now, they could guarantee that if they were willing to pay more for it. But the then president of IKEA told me that they could not pay more for it because his consumers insisted on the very lowest prices. Now, of course, my question is, if consumers knew that by paying a little more, the wood would be legally harvested, perhaps some would be willing to do so, but we're not given that choice. It's made for us.
Oh, IKEA likes to advertise its green image, its low-watt bulbs and so forth, but really, how green is IKEA?
Well, you know, as one environmental advocate, actually an urban designer, said to me in the greater Boston area, you know, IKEA is the least sustainable company on the planet. I don't know if I could agree with that, but I think it's an interesting comment. It has very, very large stores that are located generally large distances from urban centers, which means that on average consumers have to drive about 50 miles round trip to get to an IKEA. So you're obviously burning fossil fuels as you do that. They're not often close to public transportation. Some are, but mostly they're not. They have a very high fee delivery service, so most people do not make use of it because it can double the cost of a piece of furniture from IKEA if you do engage their delivery service, which is not a big part of the company. So you tend to drive your car there to get it. You tend to drive your car there when it doesn't work for you, which is often the case. They externalize a lot of their costs as well as their environmental costs as well as their financial costs. So it's a very interesting company. As I say, they do a little window dressing by charging, for example, for their plastic bags. If you use a plastic bag at IKEA, apparently around the world, I don't know if this is true, obviously, I haven't been to IKEA, it's all over the world. Certainly in North America, they charge you, I think, something like 5 cents for that bag. And they claim that as an environmental a benefit. Now, of course, they're, again, externalizing the cost. You have to pay if you make that decision. If it wasn't a profitable thing for IKEA, they would not do it. And as I said, the founding director of IKEA is always in the top 10 and often in the top 4 or 5 richest men every year on the globe. So it's a very, very profitable company for the owner and his family.
Now, IKEA and some of these other big box stores like Walmart and so forth, they build cheap goods at low costs. How long are these goods supposed to last us?
You know, sometimes they are very durable. I mean, it really is. It really depends on the object in question. The thing is, you can never. It's very hard to be sure. In the case of IKEA, for example, they actually run an advertisement talking about how their lamps are not meant to last. It's a humorous ad done very, very well by a very well-known film director, American film director. And the narrator of the commercial said, you know, why would you want to have this last? A new one is so much better. So they're not really thinking about sustainability. And in fact, responses to my book have included people who said, well, we don't really care about, things lasting. We move all the time, and we don't really care to have things last. I think that's an interesting comment, but I also think it might be a little naive, because I think that having an object that lasts means that you can sell that object. You can maybe put it on Craigslist and sell it, and you know, ultimately, you may pay very little for it if you're able to own it for a short time and then sell it. The idea of buying disposable things means that you're really sort of only renting that object. You only have it for as long as the manufacturer has basically allowed you to have it, because it hasn't been built to last. And so you can't resell that object. So I think it's an interesting idea that, that people, especially I think some young people, say they change, you know, they move their apartment every 2 years, and why would they want something that's lasting? Well, you know, I think that in fact some of this stuff is too expensive to buy for a year or two. It's not as cheap as one would think. For example, an IKEA bookshelf costs quite a bit more than assembling a bookshelf for yourself out of boards and cinder blocks. You know, it is. You are paying for it, and you know, trees are being chopped down to produce it. So you may want to think twice about thinking that it's a disposable thing.
Now, you mentioned craftsmen or crafted goods earlier as a kind of alternative to all these cheap goods or discount goods.
You know, I did a little section on craftsmanship, and I don't want that to be interpreted as I think that we need to all buy highly crafted goods. I don't. It's very nice if we own one or two things that are produced by wonderful craftsmen, but most of us can't afford highly crafted things. I certainly don't have very many unless they're made by, I have a friend who is a weaver, and she makes me as gifts beautiful things. I don't actually buy those things. She gives them to me as a gift, and I prize them very, very much. So like most people, I can't go out and buy craftsmen's, you know, things made by craftsmen. And I know that some critics of the book have said that I said that, and I haven't. It's nowhere in the book that I suggest that. What I do say, though, is that we have kind of lost our relationship with objects has changed dramatically. We no longer really expect that much of many of the things we buy. We assume they're going to break. That's why we buy extended warranties on electronics, for example. We don't trust that what we buy is going to last beyond 18 months. So we'll spend more at the cash register to say, well, I can't count on this thing. I have to pay extra because I don't trust this object. I don't trust the manufacturer of this object. Our attitude toward a lot of consumer goods is, well, you know, it's cheap, it's not great, but you know, it's okay, it kind of does the job, but oftentimes it doesn't do the job, and we don't really expect it to do the job. We know it's cheap, and we know it's not, you know, going to work for us over time, so it kind of controls us rather than us controlling it. We have a different view of objects. We don't necessarily believe we'll be able to fix them ourselves because they don't hold up to repair. And even if we did hope to fix them, because we have so much disposable, as we, you know, the culture's become somewhat disposable, it's becoming harder and harder to find people to fix these things for us. So it's not that I'm saying we need elegant, crafted things. I mean, those are nice for gifts and a special occasion. But what we've given up is just expecting good quality. And that's very, very different from demanding highly crafted things. It's really just about demanding a craftsmanship, just good, solid workmanship of our objects. And that could be in anything. And I think our parents and our grandparents expected that when they purchased, for example, a coat, that it was well put together. It may not be fancy, it may not be handmade, but their expectation was that it was well put together and it would last, and they could pass it on if they wanted to. That's not necessarily the expectation we have of things we buy anymore, because we're marketed to by price, and price often obscures what the object really is. And that's what I'm talking about. It's a much more complicated argument than just saying, well, gee, you know, I think things should be handcrafted. Nothing could be further from the truth.
What can we do as consumers or just as citizens to change this cheap product system in which we currently live?
Knowledge, you know, there's a famous anthropologist that once said that I'm paraphrasing here, that knowledge in the marketplace is the scarcest thing and the most valuable thing. And armed with knowledge, we can be a lot more effective in terms of in how we spend our money. We can kind of vote with our dollars and as well as our feet, and we can make decisions. So, you know, we can look for products that are going to last us. we can educate ourselves as to what is going to be most effective for us in our life, and we can be aware of the various techniques that marketers use to distract us and become much more effective shoppers. And I can tell you from my own experience that shopping is a lot more fun once you become a little bit hardened to the come-ons of discounters, because those siren songs of discounting make you a bit frantic, you know? You kind of go into a store and you feel, wow, I've got to buy this, I've got to buy that, it's such a good deal, I'll be a sucker if I don't buy this. And oftentimes you've gone into the store with intentions to buy one thing, and you get pulled into buying something else, and you're quite happy, unhappy, when you return home and say, gee, you know, I got this because it was a bit cheaper, but, you know, it's really not what I wanted. So I think it's actually not the least depressing. It's actually quite empowering to know how this all works so you can become more effective in how you make your purchases. I also think that, you know, personally, I believe on a political level, I think that consumer goods should be labeled with a country of origin, and that maybe companies, big, especially large discount retailers, should have on their websites something of a list of suppliers so the consumers can take a look and decide for themselves whether they really want to patronize these particular suppliers. I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't think it's nothing to do with interference with trade. It's simply information that consumers can use or not use, depending on how they feel about all this. But I think that there are a lot of deceptive practices that go on that people can inform themselves of and then make their own decisions about how they want to proceed.
Thanks very much for talking with us today, Ellen.
Thank you, Sean. It's been a great pleasure.
And that was a conversation I had earlier this week with Ellen Ruppel-Schell. She's a professor of journalism at Boston University. She's also the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. You can learn more about her book by going to ellenruppelschell.com.